Okay, a very good morning to you, colleagues. Thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva for this press briefing today, Tuesday, the 28th of October. Another very important briefing out of Geneva for you. We'll start off immediately with colleagues who will speak to the situation as it's unfolding in the Caribbean on Hurricane Melissa, which, of course, is a big development in the region. So we have connected, we have Ms. Anne-Claire Fontaine, who's joining us on Zoom. She's going to speak first from the World Meteorological Organization, and we also have a colleague from the IFRC. We also have Tommaso here, Mr. Magendi, who's joining us from Trinidad and Tobago, Port of Spain, and then Jens, of course, from OCHA will also chime in on this important story. So we'll start off immediately with Ms. Fontaine. So over to you, ma'am.
Thank you very much. So about the briefing regarding Hurricane Category 5 Melissa. So it's I cannot share the email satellite picture now, but it's a massive hurricane heading towards Jamaica, and it would have a direct impact in the coming hours into Jamaica. So the winds for Jamaica is expected to reach about 280 kilometers per hour, with gusts picking up to 350 kilometers per hour. The National Hurricane Center in Miami is saying that within the eyewall, the total structural failure is likely. I have never seen this sentence before. So it's a massive impact that is expected to be in Jamaica. Regarding rainfall, it's a lot of rainfall. It's until thrice the amount of rainy months in Jamaica. It's up to 700 millimeters that is expected during the events. What does it mean? It means that there will be catastrophic flash floodings and numerous landslides. In addition to the rain and to the destructive wind, you will have storm surge that is expected as well on the southern coast of Jamaica, with 3 to 4 meters high, in addition to destructive waves. So it's a catastrophic situation that is expected to be in Jamaica. This is for direct impact today. According to the archive and records, it is since Gilbert in 1998 that Jamaica has not been directly impacted by such a powerful hurricane, and Gilbert was a Category 4. So we have to expect the worst for this situation to unfolding now. I just want to make a word as well that Melissa will continue its track towards southeast Cuba and then the Bahamas, bringing again a lot of rain and destructive wind, as well as storm surge. And not to forget that even Dominican Republic and Haiti have already been impacted while Hurricane Melissa, I mean, the tropical storm was developing. But once again, now that Melissa is tracking north, northeastward, Dominican Republic and Haiti will have again some rain and wind, so there will be likely some additional impact in these countries. So this is what I wanted to share with you right now. Should we have any questions, feel free to ask. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fontaine. I'm going to throw it right away to our colleague who's joining us from Port of Spain again, Nesefor Magendi, who's IFRC's head of delegation for the English and Dutch-speaking Caribbean for the IFRC. Sir, over to you.
Yes, also, thank you. And as my speaker before me has made, the Category 5 system, which will be the strongest on planet this year, if most probably is threatening in Jamaica as we speak, a few hours to landfall. Up to 1 million people at risk, including families, which are still recovering from hurricane burial. If you remember, it's just 16 months ago. Coastal communities remain financially strained. Informal settlements are highly exposed to destructive winds and already saturated soils. This is because it's been the rainy season, and there's the increased likelihood of landslides and life-threatening floods, and was mentioned also earlier. about storm surges, which is a big severely concern. They indicated totals of rainfalls that may be triple what the accumulation recorded during Beryl. And because the Melissa is moving at a very slow speed, but it also has huge potential rainfall. Extreme rainfall, storm surge, sustained winds could also cause extensive infrastructure damage, isolating communities and cutting off essential services for days and if not weeks. The humanitarian threat is severe and it's immediate. And authorities have declared the entire island under threat, enabling life-saving protective measures which are underway, including preemptive evacuations and safeguards to ensure goods and remain available and affordable, which means prices are being controlled at the moment. Women, children, older people, people with disabilities are particularly vulnerable, especially in the fishing coastal communities. For the past week, Jamaican Red Cross has mobilized at the highest level. In fact, they have done what is quite impressive. They've been informed by focus, guided by risk analysis, and rooted in the trust which they hold with the communities. Volunteers have supported evacuations, are supporting evacuations, assisting authorities in delivering assistance and reinforcing early warning messages to ensure that people reached shelters on time. To enable swift relief, including items which we had already pre-positioned in the islands, among them tarpaulins, shelter toolkits, hygiene kits, and blankets. Many of them have been released to branches ahead of the storm, and at least 400 volunteers, now heading to 500, have been mobilized and have been supporting in the distribution and the activities I mentioned, including making sure people can get out of harm's way. That's the best way to do, because aid must be faster, closer, and more effective, and the local responders are there. Because preparedness is grounded in science, local knowledge, community trust, and that's what saves lives. And because in a crisis like this, every minute counts, we hope for the best, but we have to prepare for the worst. So alongside our teams, we have activated our global network, our disaster risk emergency response emergency fund. We allocated 80,000 Swiss francs, which are around 16 million Jamaican dollars, to reinforce early action activities that I mentioned, including strengthening logistics and ensuring people are committed, are protected. We anticipate that the humanitarian needs will escalate rapidly, in fact, in the hours ahead, and not because of the focus, but also because of the decades' experience show that storms like this could cause lasting damage. Most importantly, Hurricane Beryl, to which we are actually supporting responses now, especially recovery, left little time for recovery. Many families are still actually rebuilding now. Some of them are restoring their livelihoods now. Some of them are putting infrastructure now. Melissa now threatens the same communities, and maybe all the activities will be wiped out. This is an example of how climate-related events and extreme climate weather events can actually provide shocks to communities and stretch the capacities to withstand them. And as we speak today, it will be very difficult for tens of thousands, if not millions of people in Jamaica. Roofs will be tested, floodwater will rise, isolation will become a harsh reality for many. For us, the immediate priorities are clear. We have to get to know who needs what where. That's the assessment that we have to do immediately. As soon as conditions allow safety, we have to deliver needs-based assistance based on what we have already in place, which has been pre-positioned, and then supporting the restorations of social essential services. We make sure that if maritime activities are actually restarted, we may then open the routes for relief. We have to replenish what is in place and distribute. And we anticipate there will be a surge and need for international solidarity. So the volunteers who are embedded within their communities are ready to move once it's safe. And we stand ready as IFRC, including the Red Cross, Red Crescent societies around the region, to scale up as needed. We stand ready to enforce Jamaica's local preparedness and as global as necessary. So we really urge there will be a need for global solidarity and the full strength of the humanitarian response, including by the Red Cross and other partners. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Global solidarity is the key. Now, Jens is here, who could provide details on the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, which is coordinating closely with the resident coordinators and the UN country teams in the region. So he's here to take any questions you might have as well. So over to you now for your questions to any of the three, and if you can point your questions or indicate who you want to direct your questions to, that would be helpful. Starting in the room first. Yes, Emma, Reuters.
Good morning. A question for the Red Cross, please. Can you tell us on what scale the evacuations have taken place? How many people have been moved, and where are they sheltering? Thank you.
Mr. McGinty. Go ahead. We can't hear you. The question was on evacuations, where they're being relocated. Yeah, I think maybe try to unmute again. It seems to be an audio issue here. Okay, now we can hear you. Go ahead, please.
Right, thank you for that question. The authorities had prepared at least 800 shelters which were being used to get people there. Now, as of yesterday, hundreds of people had gone. We still not have the figures on how many more have gone as of last night, but 818 shelters had been prepared by the authorities. To mention that the main priority was to get people out of harm's way. And we're hoping that as many of them have been able to get out of that to reduce the number of casualties which may happen in a severe storm like this.
Thank you very much, sir. Do we have further questions? Yes, Isabel of Spanish News Agency. Isabel.
Good morning. I would like to know what are the preparations in Cuba, what kind of prepositioned items you have there, because also the hurricane is approaching the side of Guantanamo, I understand. Thank you.
Maybe we can start with you, Mr. McGendy. I don't know if Jens, if you have anything to add, please jump in. Mr. McGendy on Cuba.
Again, the audio. Yeah. Okay. I think you can hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Thank you for the question. Yes, in Cuba, the Cuban Red Cross has also, we have supplies which are in country, but also which we can take from the nearby countries, which can reach also within 4 hours by flight and a few days by ship. The volunteers likewise have been disseminating early warning messages, helping communities to get out of harm's way. And you mentioned Cuba, but also after Cuba, the storm will be heading to Bahamas. Again, it's somewhere where we are following up. Again, you remember the impacts of us at previous hurricanes in the Union of the Bahamas. So after Cuba, we have Red Cross teams which are ready in Cuba, in the Bahamas, which is likely also to be impacted. As mentioned, rains will also extend to Haiti and Dominica.
Thank you very much. If you have anything to add, Jens, of course, go ahead.
Just to add on that, we have activated what we call the Anticipatory Action Framework, which is kind of predetermined triggers for a number of actions, including an allocation of $4 million from the Central Emergency Response Fund. So that has already gone out, right, in anticipation of this. This allocation has already allowed our partners to pre-position food and essential supplies, and that includes rice, grains, hygiene kits, fuel vouchers, and portable water treatment plants. And that is in Cuba's eastern provinces, which is, you know, expected to be very severely hit. And of course, all of this is done in collaboration and coordination with the national authorities. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jens. Nina, AFP.
Yeah, first for IFRC, I was wondering if you could say again how many people you think will be impacted by this, or how many you fear could be impacted. And then on the pre-positioning of aid, I was wondering if you could say a little bit about the impact of the budget cuts that we're aware of, how that might have impacted the amounts of aid that's being pre-positioned, and what your fears are surrounding that. Thank you.
Okay, maybe once again we'll go with you, Mr. Magendie.
Thank you for the question. Your two questions. So, in terms of the preposition of items, we have items which within Jamaica itself, IFRC had items of which would provide immediate assistance to 800 households plus. And those have been released and will be going. Within the region, we also have supplies which can get to 60,000 households, and those can be gotten to Jamaica and also in other countries like Bahamas within 4 to 2 hours, as I mentioned. The supplies themselves, we've had these in stock. Fortunately, before this, these are stocks we have had preceding. Some of them haven't actually been positioned with the support of programs which are going funded by the US government previously. And those were items which are being mobilized now. We anticipate after we release them, there will be a need to replenish. And that's where we're hoping for global solidarity. And my experience in disaster response, mainly in across all parts of the world, is that in events like this, the world comes together. And we anticipate this will be the case. This is a storm of one of the storms of the centuries. And I believe the global community will come together to respond collectively. At this point, I think our concern is to make sure that lives are protected as much as possible. People get out of harm's way. And the people in the shelters also will get assistance.
In terms of the number of people that could be impacted, and of course, Ms. Fontana, if you have anything to add, just put your hand up as well. But if either of you can address this point.
Yes, so in terms of number of people affected, we had projected, if you see the storm itself shifted a little bit west. Initially, it was heading the eastern part, and that means it's moved away from the metropolitan area of the Kingston, and which is a high population area. It has gone a little bit way west, but it doesn't mean that's everyone else's spared. Its bandwidth is massive. If we estimate, I mentioned 1.5 million people may be impacted, but that's an underestimate, because the impacts on people will include disruptions of essential services, impacts on markets, schools will be closed, and landslides will block roads. It means the entire populations may feel the impact one way or the other. Of course, the most vulnerable, the ones I mentioned, the people in the coastal areas, the fisher folks, the people whose livelihoods are being restored now after burial, are the ones who have felt the impact the most, but by large, the entire island will be impacted.
Thank you very much. Did you have a quick follow-up, Nina? Go ahead.
Sorry, it was also for Jens, because you also mentioned the aid, and I was just wondering if you've seen any impact of budget cuts on the amount of aid that you've been able to preposition.
Yeah, thanks, Nina. No, not yet. We don't know how much this is going to cost yet. So before we have a budget for that, we can't say whether it's well or not well funded, right? So we have to see that. What is important to stress is, I think, it's an astounding number of countries, right, and number of organizations and national authorities and IFRC and UN and what have you. And there's an extraordinary amount of collaboration and coordination. It's quite impressive to see. That's why I back down from briefing proactively right now, because all the numbers that I have were just briefed by my colleagues, because there is this very, I would say, well-established and long-standing collaboration in the region. So that's absolutely a plus. That's great. I also want to mention we have in Panama quite a big hub of UN, including OCHA's regional office, and there's warehouses there as well, which is fully mobilized with stuff already paid for and, you know, at hand to distribute to where this hits the worst. But I think everybody is really mobilized to the maximum. If we are indeed looking at the storm of the century, which we are, we are where we need to be at this point. Time will tell how hard it's going to hit Jamaica, how hard it's going to hit Cuba, how hard it's going to hit Bahamas and further down the line. It is moving slowly. When we say slowly, my understanding is it's currently about 6 kilometers per hour, right? So that's quite slow. But the winds, as we heard, are up to 280 kilometers per hour. That's massive. And the amount of rain it's going to dump is up to 1,000 millimeters in Cuba. That's a meter of rain, right? Sorry, 1,000 in Jamaica and up to 500 millimeters in Cuba. So between a meter and half a meter of rain, that's almost unimaginable when that comes in a span of a few hours. And that's why we're warning about flash floods, landslides, and so on.
Thank you very much for that, Jens. Emma.
May I please ask WMO to put this storm in perspective for us? I mean, a couple of you mentioned the storm of the century. Is this true? Is it the strongest storm in a century? Can you just tell us how it compares with previous storms in recent years and decades? Thank you.
Ms. Fontaine?
Thank you so much for the questions. It's for Jamaica, it will be the storm of the century so far, that's for sure. Regarding at the world level, it's for the season is the most intense, even compared with Typhoon Ragasa that was going out in the Northwest Pacific last month. So it's more powerful than Typhoon Ragasa. For this region, you will have Maria, and for example, that will be much more powerful than Melissa. But once again, when it comes to Jamaica, it's the worst direct impact that they had in history.
Thank you very much for that perspective, Ms. Fontaine. Further questions in the room? No, I don't see. Oh, we do. Okay, Isabel again from FA.
Just, I understand that everything is important, but given that this is an extraordinarily powerful hurricane, what is the order of priorities when once the hurricane have gone, and what is the order in the assistance in the humanitarian aid? Thank you.
So, first order of business is to save as many lives as possible in the event. That's why we are seeing evacuations going on, shelters being built, you know, advice is going out. We are sending out advice as well, what to do in these situations, how to protect yourself and your immediate family and community and so on. So that's the first order, to limit the immediate impact of it. Then, a bit further down the line, of course, people will need, if it is as catastrophic as it looks like it's going to be in Jamaica and Cuba, what are going to be people's basic survival needs? Food, clean water. As you know, that's very important. It's a bit counterintuitive that when you have massive flooding, one of the biggest problems is water, right? Because the water that you have is not clean. And there is risk, all kind of health risks and epidemic risks if you don't have clean water. So food, clean water, shelter, and of course medical care. So that will stretch for a period of time. It's impossible to say how long, several weeks probably. And then of course there's a whole other kind of wave of support that needs to come into the region so that people can get back on their feet and reconstruct. And that is a much longer timeline, and that is something, of course, first you have to have a full impact assessment of what has been destroyed, what needs to be rebuilt, and then do that in collaboration with the authorities. The governments of these countries are, of course, always in control and in charge and in lead, and we are there from the UN system to support with that. We're in it, as we always are, for the long run. We've been there before this happened. That's why we have things such as the anticipatory action framework, because we know these things may happen, and we need to, you know, push resources into a response before the emergency actually happens. We are there during the response. We plan to deploy staff as well to Cuba. I don't know how many, but people are mobilized in the region to go and help with the coordination of the response. And then, of course, further down the line, as I say, to stay and help support the rebuilding and reconstruction.
Thank you very much, Jens. Mr. Magendie or Ms. Fontaine, if you have anything to add. Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask on the numbers, if we could, again, if on the 1.5 that was mentioned, if that was just for Jamaica or if it's for the region. And for the storm of the century, are we talking about just Jamaica or is it, you know, broader? And also if we could have the notes, it would be very helpful. Thank you.
Or notes always, colleagues, if you could share notes, of course. And maybe from Ms. Fontaine, the storm of the century, and then in terms of the 1.5 million, I'll go back to you, Mr. Magendie, on that figure. But Ms. Fontaine, back to you.
Hurricane Melissa is a Cat 5, but there was, it's a very powerful one. But for example, Hurricane Maria was even stronger. So it's for the region, it's not the most powerful, but for Jamaica, it's definitely yes.
And Ms. Magendie, please.
All right, thank you. Number one, the number you mentioned, 1.5 million people who may be impacted, is an estimate on the people within the storm's path who may be impacted. That's number. If you look at the entire population of Jamaica, it's going to feel an impact. This is a massive, massive storm. It stretches hundreds of kilometers wide. Its impacts are going to be felt, have been felt actually days in advance. Rains have been pouring. And what we're saying is it's the scale of need that's going to impact the people of Jamaica. And we need to make sure that we save as many lives as possible. We support as many as possible to get out of harm's way, as well as to get immediate response and support immediately after that. So that's a number that we're saying based on the populations available at that time. Maybe to complement what you asked earlier about what we are doing, the priority, saving lives. The Red Cross volunteers who are from the local communities will be impacted, some of them, but immediately after they will go back to make sure they are looking for the people they know in areas they know, also helping in terms of search retrieval. This will be important because of the flooding, the landslide that may happen. And later on, as was mentioned by my colleague from the UN, you'll make sure that services are restored gradually. And that may take weeks, that may take days, and recovery. But there's also the problem that we may create ourselves as humanitarians. So there's the need for coordination so that we don't cramp with the supplies which are trying to get into the country, and we make sure that pipeline is done in the best manner. And when I talk about support, it's not just money, it's also about the people will be deploying the equipment. It gets in an orderly manner so that there will be a process there for logistics to be supported.
Thank you. And perhaps Tom also wants to add one important priority.
Yeah, just a quick point to add on. It's mental health and psychosocial support, which has been proven by experience critical right after actually already happening to prepare communities. And then what we have been doing all the time is restoring family links. So sometimes when these big events are happening and big disasters are happening, there are family members that got separated. And of course, across national societies are working on it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, no further questions in the room. We have one final question, perhaps John Zarakostas, France 24 in The Lancet. John.
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me there?
Yes.
Yes, my question is on another topic. I'll wait if someone else has a question still on the cyclone.
Let's exhaust the agenda, John, and I'll get back to you, I promise, at the end, unless you're...
No, I want to ask a question to Tomasa in case he leaves.
Okay. Let's take advantage of Tomasa's graceful presence here. What's your question?
Yeah. Good morning, Tomasa. I was wondering if you can bring us up to speed if the IFRC with its national chapters, what it's doing for medical evacuations out of Gaza, if you've got more evacuations in the pipeline or you're still facing impediments. And secondly, if you can bring us up to speed on latest developments in Darfur from your Red Crescent partners there. Thank you.
John, just to remind you, we have Darfur on the agenda. That's the next agenda item, in fact. Tomaso can perhaps stay here to respond to that. Maybe on the first question, maybe you want to address that, and then we'll go to Darfur afterwards. Go ahead, Tomaso.
Yeah, thank you, Rolando. Thank you, John, for the question. Regarding evacuations, actually, I don't have new information. Our national societies are supporting some of the evacuations, but they're not organizing themselves. So both in Gaza with Palestine Red Crescent, in Egypt with the Egyptian Red Crescent, but also in the Jordan Corridor in the past, the three national societies have been supporting the evacuation in terms of logistics, but also, for instance, in Egypt on supporting families, the relatives of the people who are got evacuated from Gaza, but I don't have any other information of incoming operations. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Tomaso. Okay, then on that note, colleagues, we're going to say, firstly, I want to say thank you very much to Ms. Fontaine, Mr. Magendie. I know it's very early in the morning. We're glad you're safe, and do keep us informed of developments as this hurricane makes its path. But now, colleagues, we're going to turn to another subject. This is a human-made catastrophe in Sudan, Al-Fashir region in particular. Maybe if I can ask Eugene to join us. Tomasa, if you don't mind staying, and Jens can stay here if you have time, just for maybe a few more minutes. And maybe, Eugene, if you want to introduce your colleague from the refugee agency who's joining us online. So thank you again for that.
Good morning, everyone. So as you have seen in recent news and heard from colleagues in different humanitarian agencies, the situation in Sudan has become even worse, if that's even possible, especially the Sudan's North Darfur region's capital in Al-Fashir. UNHCR, the UN refugee agency, is deeply concerned as escalating and brutal violence in Al-Fashir has forced again the thousands of civilians to flee, leaving many others trapped inside the city with a few options. So we are joining with our head of sub-office in Port Sudan, who is visiting temporarily her family in Amsterdam, but she's traveling back to Port Sudan tomorrow. So she's in close contact with her colleague, who is currently in Tawila. Over to you, Jacqueline.
Thank you very much, Yusin, and thank you very much, colleagues, for the opportunity to talk about the tragedy that is, that unfolded already, of course, a couple of years ago, affecting a lot of people, the civilians in Darfur. But also the recent developments, as Yusin highlighted, with escalating violence again in Al-Fashir, leading to yet another significant outflow out of Al-Fashir into Tawile, which is a town at about 60 kilometers away from Al-Fashir. It hosts already more than 650,000, 650,000 IDPs, and now over the past week alone, 26,000 new arrivals have been registered, have been received in Tawile. The stories that we hear through my colleagues that are on the ground in Tawila providing protection services are horrendous and horrific. There is a near breakdown of communications in Al-Fashir. However, new arrivals report of widespread ethnically and politically motivated killing indiscriminate violence affecting in particularly the most vulnerable. We have accounts of people with disabilities who were executed, who were killed as they were unable to flee. But we also hear people that are trying to leave the city and manage to get out of the city, but on the way they're caught up and they are also being shot for unknown reasons. The protection concerns and the protection needs are tremendous. We see constant violations of international human rights law, of international humanitarian law. People report the killings, arrest and detention, very often tortured in detention, but also looting, extortion, and then in particularly affecting women and children, the gender-based violence, rape, and recruitment of children into armed forces. So the overall situation pertaining to the protection of civilians is disastrous, I would say. And therefore, you know, the agencies that have presence in Tawile are really responding the best as they can. And for UNHCR, for example, we have really focused our intervention on protection assistance for individuals, but also on a group basis. We support counseling services. We try to also inject some cash into the community. For instance, recently, a woman who survived the dangerous journey from El Fasher to Tawile with her two children, her two young children, you know, was in dire need of medical care, but also cash assistance. At least, you know, she could buy some food and some and provide some support to her children. So, the crisis, as we said, is really a protection crisis. Sometimes we always hear the sort of the standard jargon, but I think in Sudan and in particularly in Darfur, we can say, and I think most recently also the humanitarian coordinator mentioned that, as well as the deputy high commissioner of UNHCR who visited Sudan, that the impact of the huge destruction of civilian infrastructure, markets, hospitals, schools, as well as private properties of people, houses have been ransacked and burned down. This in addition to the very serious violations of human rights law. It is of an extent that people have rarely seen in their long careers as humanitarian workers. I also would like to highlight the concern that we have at this point in time over the situation which is unfolding in North Kordofan. There also recently the city of Bara has been taken over by the RSF. Again, similar patterns of violence are reported coming out of Bara. We have spoken to people who were injured and managed to reach hospitals where we met them. But we also have many accounts of people that sadly have not been able to flee, and of, you know, the large scale stories of massive killings, again, ethnically and politically motivated in many instances. The call for action, as we know, is again, we need peace. We need peace immediately. We need a ceasefire. We need humanitarian corridors and humanitarian pauses in order to reach out to the people that are remaining in El Fasher. The communication outage is really impacting on our ability to have direct information. But we know, as I said, from new arrivals in Tawile that were met by my colleagues, that there are still many civilians left in El Fasher who are unable to move out. It is too dangerous, or they're physically too weak after a 500-day siege of the city. We need immediate and urgent access, humanitarian access, to the people. In addition, also the humanitarian sector is completely overwhelmed in Tawile. We need many more services, we need many more capacities on the ground in order to respond effectively to those who have fled and who are in need of safety and security. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Parlevliette. Very important briefing indeed. And before we take questions, and I just want to, of course, we have Tommaso, Jens here, and Eugene, and then we also have Saif Magango of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, who's also connected, should you have a question on the human rights front. But let me just first point you to the statement that we did issue last night on behalf of the Secretary General, through which he expresses his grave concern by the recent military escalation in El Fasher in North Darfur State. And he echoes many of the messages we just heard from our colleague from UNHCR. He adds that over the past 18 months, El Fasher and the surrounding areas in North Darfur have been an epicenter of suffering, with hundreds of thousands of civilians trapped by a tightening siege by the rapid support forces, and with malnutrition, disease, and violence claiming lives daily. So this is a statement which we shared with you late last night. Actually, it was shared with you early this morning. I should say it came out very, very late in the evening last night. But let's now turn to you colleagues for questions. Maybe we'll start with Christiane from the German news agency, and then to Nina.
Good morning, Jacqueline. A question on your call for action. We all understand what's needed, but do you have open communication lines with the rapid support forces? Are you talking to them directly? Because it doesn't seem to make a big of a difference if the UN in Geneva or New York call for peace. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the question. And I should say that the UN has maintained communication lines with all parties to the conflict. We have seen many statements also by parties to the conflict committing to protect civilians. Unfortunately, it seems that, in order to have this implemented, other issues, other things need to happen. But yes, the communication is with all parties to the conflict, and we would like to hold them to account also for their own written or oral statements and commitments that they protect civilians and that they will allow humanitarian assistance to reach the civilians that are most in need.
Thank you. And maybe just if I could echo the last comment in the statement, which I just referred to, through which the Secretary General urges that the Sudanese Armed Forces and the RSF to immediately engage with his personal envoy, Mr. Lamamra, Ramtane Lamamra, and take swift, tangible steps towards a negotiated settlement. Okay. Nina, yes.
Yeah, I had a question, I guess, for the human rights, maybe, but it was on the issue. There have been allegations that more than 2,000 people have been executed since Sunday. Is that something that the UN has numbers on, or could you provide more details about what's going on there? Thanks.
Thank you, Nina. Maybe I'll throw to Saif, your camera's on. If you have a comment on that, I'd be grateful. Go ahead.
Thanks for the question. We're aware of summary executions that have taken place. You'll have seen yesterday's statement by High Commissioner Volker Turk to that effect, but we are not able to confirm the figures due to difficulties with the internet access. Telecommunications services in the region are quite constrained, and we've not been able to verify the figures, but we are very aware of reports that there's been ethnically targeted summary executions of people, many of them accused of by the RSF of supporting the rival SAF forces. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Saif. Okay, let's just move on with questions either in the room. We have, yes, Mohammed Anadolu.
Okay, thank you so much. You explained the desperate situation in El Fasher. My question is, are you able to bring any aid to El Fasher now, or you just help these people in like outside of El Fasher, like Tavala or any other space?
Okay, go ahead.
Is that a question for me?
I believe so. Mohammed, yeah. Yes, that is for... Well, it could be, yes, if you could address that, Jacqueline, and then other colleagues, please feel free to chime in. Over to you.
Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, the UN, of course, has requested for a humanitarian pause and the delivery of humanitarian aid, as well as presence of humanitarian workers in El Fasher. To my understanding, as of today, this permission still hasn't been granted. Hence, we have no access at all to people in El Fasher, to civilians in El Fasher. And in fact, the lack of access dates, I would say, well over a year, that it is virtually impossible to access people in El Fasher and provide protection and humanitarian aid.
Thanks for clarifying that, Jacqueline. Okay, let's move on to a question from the Kuwait News Agency, Iman.
Thank you so much. Just one question. Do you have any figures on the level of malnutrition and...
You're coming in a little bit garbled, Iman. I don't know if it's me, but if you can...
I think I have, like...
Go ahead.
You heard me now.
Yes, it's better now. Please go ahead.
Okay. Thank you so much. Just a question. Do you have any figures on the level of malnutrition and the number? No.
Oh,
I will.
Sorry.
No. I will write the question.
I'm happy to read it out for you, okay. if you could put it in the chat, with pleasure.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Iman. Sorry for that. Let's... Maybe in the mean... Oh, yeah, Simon.
Yes, do you have an estimation of how many people are still in El Fasher?
Maybe Jacqueline, if that's a question for you, how many people remain in El Fasher? I think it's, as clearly illustrated, we haven't had access, and it's very hard to determine this. But maybe if you want to share with us what you know, Jacqueline, and, of course, any other colleagues.
Well, as you said, indeed, it is very hard to estimate the number of civilians remaining in El Fasher. And the numbers we have, they vary from maybe around 6,000 civilians to well over 260,000 civilians still remaining in El Fasher. I think at this point in time, nobody is really able to assert how many civilians are still remaining in El Fasher. That being said, under the leadership of OCHA, we have a response plan prepared, and the planning figures are, I believe, around 50,000 to 100,000. But maybe our colleague from OCHA can confirm that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Jacqueline. Okay, I think I haven't seen the question yet come in from Iman. Maybe we'll give that a second. In the meantime, I think Tomaso, I think John, you had a question, but maybe Tomaso can just add a comment on that.
Yeah, no, thanks. Thanks, John, for the question. Actually, I need to come back to you on this one. I have to admit that we have also issues of communications in terms of speaking with our teams, our volunteers of Sudanese Red Crescent. But let me just echo what UN colleagues have been saying. I mean, the situation in Sudan, the humanitarian situation in Sudan is horrific. What we have been seeing for too many months and years is just getting worse. And I just want to, again, echo the call call on protection of civilians, whether they stay or leave in the case of Al-Fashir, but in general all around the country, protection of humanitarians, access for humanitarians. And I just want to remind that even humanitarian workers have been killed during this horrific tragedy, this horrific armed conflict. Sudanese Red Crescent have lost nine, but I mean, this sadly, it's across the board, and it's something that is unacceptable for all of us. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Tommaso. Okay, now I can refer to the question that Iman poses from the Kuwait News Agency. Perhaps this is directed to WHO or even UNICEF, who are connected online. She's asking whether we have any figures on level of malnutrition and number of people, especially children, who have died from hunger in Al-Fashir or Darfur. Again, this is maybe tricky to come up with these numbers, but colleagues, I don't know if it's Christian and James, if you're online, if you have any updates on that front, that would be helpful. Is Christian, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much. And let me try to give an answer to this. I don't have detailed replies and not locked down onto Al-Fashir or other areas, but I have something between the 1st of January and 30 September of 2025. So in the last 9 months, over 31,000 children. So 31,418 children have been admitted to stabilization centers for the treatment of severe acute malnutrition with medical complications. That's what we see at those centers. The underlying figures, we don't really have data on at this point. And the situation is especially critical, of course, for populations trapped in the areas affected by the direct conflict and or the insecurity and the lack of protection, particularly in Greater Darfur, Greater Kordofan, Khartoum and Al Jazeera states and Al-Fashir, of course. Since the start of the conflict, there have been a significant surge in acute malnutrition in 2025. 3.7 million people are in need of nutrition response. And UNICEF, to quote here, estimates that 770,000 children under 5 years will suffer from severe acute malnutrition in 2025.
Thank you very much. Grim statistics indeed, but thank you very much for sharing. I stand corrected. I'm afraid James from UNICEF is not connected, but of course, if you have any questions for UNICEF specifically, you can always point them to James or colleagues. Further questions on the situation in Sudan?
Excuse me. Yes, a clarification.
Yeah, go ahead, Isabel.
Christian, the 30,000 stabilization centers are in all Darfur area, or I didn't hear that. Sorry. Thank you.
No. Thanks for asking and checking back. No, it's 31,418 children that have been admitted to stabilization centers for the treatment of severe acute malnutrition with medical stabilization.
Excuse me, you're right. Is it where exactly?
That's figures for Sudan in general. I don't have a breakdown.
Okay. Thanks, Christian, and thanks, colleagues, for the interest in this horrific story. And, of course, we'll provide you with notes, details, numbers, all these things that we can to make sure your reporting is accurate and timely. John, before we wrap up, Sudan, I think you wanted to come back on your previous question, or is it something else?
Yes, actually, excellent question to Christian. Christian, you mentioned 31,418 have been admitted to centers. But you mentioned the UNICEF figure is 770,000 children will be suffering from SAM this year. So how many are not getting treatment? That's a huge number if the UNICEF estimates are there. And how many have already died from severe acute malnutrition? That seems to be a huge gap between the number that need a treatment and how many are not getting it.
You're absolutely right, John. And the math, I mean, if you look at the grim figures, the math seems stunning. But I'm not sure you can make that easy math here. I don't have a breakdown of how many would have been admitted, how many the actual figures are. That's an estimation also by UNICEF that I just quoted here. And that goes for the whole of 2025, whereas what we just had were the admitted stabilization center admitted children up till September, end of September. So yes, a huge discrepancy in the figures of those who might need urgent treatment and suffering from severe acute malnutrition, Sam, as you said, and those actually receiving treatment, which is unfortunately not rare in such circumstances, but I don't have a further breakdown, unfortunately.
Okay, well noted. Thank you again, Christian. I think, colleagues, that wraps up our discussion on Sudan. I'd like to thank you all. Jacqueline, I know you're heading back to Sudan. Thank you very, very much for joining us. Good luck to you and all the best to you and your colleagues. And thank you again, Jens, Tommaso, and Eugene, for joining us here. Okay, colleagues, we're going to shift to Afghanistan. And I'm looking at Jeremy from the Office for the High Commission for Human Rights, who will join me here in a second. Yep. So thanks, Jeremy, from the OHCHR on Afghanistan telecoms shutdown. Over to you.
Yes, thanks, Rollo. Good morning, everyone. This morning, the UN Human Rights Office and the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan published a briefing paper on the serious and far-reaching human rights impacts of last month's telecommunication shutdown in Afghanistan, a measure which only served to compound the array of difficulties already faced by the population. From its health systems to the banking sector and everyday operations of small businesses, the people of Afghanistan are heavily reliant on telecommunication systems to access essential services. This paper is based on more than 100 interviews in the aftermath of the 48-hour nationwide shutdown implemented by the de facto authorities between the 29th of September and the 1st of October of this year. Among the human rights impacts documented were delayed or no access to healthcare and emergency services, disruption of humanitarian operations, exacerbation of existing discriminatory restrictions on women and girls, infringement on people's daily and family lives due to the inability to contact others, and disruption of the conduct of business and banking. Women and girls in Afghanistan have already been subjected to the most draconian restrictions. Women interviewed shared their experiences of how their lives became even more difficult during the shutdown. For example, some women were unable to contact their male guardians or mahrams during the shutdown. In Afghanistan, women must be accompanied by a mahram for distances over 78 kilometres or when travelling in a vehicle. In some parts of the country, mahrams are required to accompany a woman when she is going shopping, to work, or to a healthcare facility less than 78 kilometres from her home. One woman was unable to contact her father for this purpose and was forced to walk home alone. In her words, "I was very scared when I was on my way home, but fortunately, I made it home safely after about 1 hour." Online learning remains the only avenue left for many Afghan women and girls to receive an education because of the de facto authorities' ban on women and girls continuing any education beyond the sixth grade. One student said, "I can simply say that those were very difficult days and nights for us during the shutdown. We were extremely terrified that we may be pulled to the Stone Age era of human history. It was an unbearable period of my life." Healthcare workers spoke about preventable deaths which occurred because of the shutdown. A pregnant woman went to a hospital in Lagman province with severe bleeding and needed to be urgently transferred to the provincial hospital for treatment. But the hospital's ambulance had broken down and there was no way to call for help. The baby died and the woman survived with complications. The nurse said, "As a health worker, I'm trained to save lives, but without communication, I was feeling helpless." Humanitarian workers said the shutdown seriously disrupted their work and delayed the provision of vital support to the population. At the time, humanitarians were responding to the needs and communities impacted by the earthquake on the 31st of August, which hit Nangarhar, Lagman and Kunar provinces, as well as an influx of people involuntarily returned from Pakistan. Shutdowns and other disproportionate restrictions on communications violate the rights to freedom of expression and access to information and are contrary to Afghanistan's human rights obligations. The de facto authorities have made no public comment to date on the reasons for this shutdown. As duty bearers of Afghanistan's human rights obligations, they must ensure that any restrictions on the rights to freedom of expression and access to information are provided by law and are necessary and proportionate response to a legitimate concern under international human rights law. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Very important report indeed. Turning to you, colleagues, for any questions you might have on Afghanistan telecom shutdown? No, I don't see that's the case. I think it was very comprehensive and very important indeed. I think you had another item?
Yes.
Okay, an ASEAN. Okay, separate item on ASEAN.
Thanks, Rollo. Yes, we'll be issuing a news release imminently. This is a High Commissioner news release. This is on the ASEAN Declaration on the Right to a Healthy Environment. We welcome the adoption by ASEAN of a landmark regional declaration on the right to a healthy environment. The declaration was announced today after being adopted on Sunday during the ASEAN summit in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. The ASEAN Declaration on the Right to a Safe, Clean, Healthy and Sustainable Environment marks a vital step forward as the latest regional affirmation of the right to a healthy environment across Southeast Asia. The High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, calls on ASEAN states to build on the declaration to ensure coordinated leadership and timely action toward addressing transboundary environmental harms. These include climate change, land, water and air pollution, and should include the meaningful participation of the most affected, including women, young people and Indigenous peoples. He also emphasises the particular need to ensure the effective protection of environmental human rights defenders and their essential work. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Colleagues, I should also remind you that the Secretary General Antonio Guterres was in Kuala Lumpur for the 15th ASEAN UN summit that took place yesterday. And we did share with you statements that he delivered there, as well as remarks at a press conference parallel to this important gathering. So do we have questions for Jeremy on this declaration? No, I don't see that's the case. You have a, okay, on another subject, go ahead, Musa. Okay, so no questions on ASEAN, just to make sure, yeah, okay. So Musa, over to you.
Okay, thank you very much. It's for Lebanon. UN Special Rapporteur Maurice Tidball-Binz, I don't know if it's correct, said that Israel strikes targeting vehicles in Lebanon since the ceasefire could constitute a war crime, particularly the targeting of a vehicle in September 21, which killed five people. I'm asking the Lawrence, maybe if you see this action like a war crime. And I remember you that since the ceasefire in December or November 24, 300 people was killed in Lebanon and about 500 injured. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And it's good that you brought up Lebanon, because often it's a forgotten subject, because since the ceasefire, we've actually at least 111 civilians, that is 74 men, 21 women and 16 children, have been killed by Israeli forces, and more than 82,000 remain displaced. We're aware of these continued Israeli airstrikes in Lebanon, obviously gravely, deeply concerned. And all efforts need to be put towards making this peace, toward bringing peace and ensuring this ceasefire is put into place and is maintained. The protection of civilians are paramount.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. And Musa, let me just maybe mention that the UN Special Coordinator for Lebanon, Janine Hennis-Plechet, is currently in Israel. She began a visit to that country yesterday, and as part of her regular consultations there with stakeholders, she will be discussing Security Council Resolution 1701. And chiefly, she'll be talking about the November 2024 cessation of hostilities arrangement. Of course, the overarching goal is advancing security and stability on both sides of the blue line. So this is something that we will certainly report back to you on any public statements, any readout we have on Ms. Hennis-Plechet's efforts, meetings in the region. You had a follow-up, or is that...
Just about the difference between your numbers. You said 110, maybe, and the Ministry of Health in Lebanon said about 300 killed. And why this difference for you? Thank you.
Yeah, it's 111 civilians. This is the latest information we have, and it's... these are numbers that have been verified by our office, which is different to the other numbers you're talking about. So we systematically go through the process of verifying all numbers.
And the rest are not civilians, or what?
We continue to verify the numbers. It's not to say that they're not civilians. The other numbers that you're referring to, which are the 300 figure, we will systematically go through all these numbers. That could well increase as we do our own verification procedure, in line with our normal protocols.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you once again, Jeremy. I think that concludes the questions, I think, for you. And before we wrap up, and thank you once again for joining us here, I mentioned the statements we shared with you. The only additional items I have is just to note the meetings taking place here at the Palais that we are supporting. Firstly, the expert mechanism on the right to development, which started yesterday. It's a three-day session, the 12th session of this important group, a meeting in room 16, talking about various subjects, including the participation, what kind of participation is needed, improving the well-being of individuals, and the impact of tariffs on the realization of human rights, creative industries. So these are among the issues being discussed during this three-day meeting. And just to let you know, we are producing meeting summaries for the first time for this body, as well as webcast services. Later this week, on Thursday, Friday, the 30th and the 31st, the Social Forum, which is a subsidiary body of the Human Rights Council, will also meet for its 2025 session. And the focus will be on education for all, human rights and education, the protection thereof. So a very important subject, of course. The High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mr. Volker Turk, will address the forum at the opening of the meeting on Thursday. So there you have it. No further items from me. That's right. So any questions before we wrap up? Yeah, maybe Musa, then Simone. Go ahead, Musa.
J'ai une question très rapide pour Catherine, peut-être, concernant la conférence de presse de minuit. Je voudrais savoir pourquoi vraiment on a insisté de faire une conférence de presse à minuit. Il n'y a personne aux Nations Unies. Pourquoi on n'a pas fait ça le lendemain? Juste une question d'organisation, mais peut-être.
Liz, I'll leave it to you, Catherine, to respond to that, of course. Maybe if you wanted to come up here, if you don't mind. In the meantime, maybe I'll turn to you, Simon. You had a question?
Yeah, any update on Gaza, on the number of trucks entering the Gaza Strip?
Certainly. Well, we had Jens here, but of course you should consult the updates that we share with you, which provide some details. I'll have to consult with Jens and other colleagues should they have any updates. Of course, the importance is to allow unhindered access. We need deliveries at scale, at speed. So we'll have to get back to you on specific numbers. As you know, there's a lot of interest in the truck flow and then, of course, relieving those desperate populations which have been affected for far too long. So let me get back to you on that one, Simone, and on the press conference.
Oui, bonjour à tous. Moussa, on doit arbitrer entre plusieurs contraintes qui ont été la longueur des interventions des États membres suite à l'adoption du consensus de Genève et vous donner l'information de la conclusion de cet accord. Il n'était pas possible de le faire le vendredi matin, donc l'arbitrage c'était de faire un statement de la secrétaire générale tardivement, effectivement. C'est un moment un peu exceptionnel, c'est tous les quatre ans qu'on renégocie notre mandat, enfin que les États membres renégocient le mandat. Et c'est pour cette raison que c'était un petit peu chaotique et finalement que ça s'est terminé tard.
Merci beaucoup, Catherine. I think that does it for our briefing then. I wish you a good afternoon and see you here on Friday. Thanks.